South Summit School District started back to school this year. They also opened up with full-day kindergarten in the studio with details on that and more. I have the superintendent of South Summit School, Shad Sorensen. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. So before we get to kindergarten, how did last night's opportunities night go? You didn't have to move it inside?
It was amazing. We had a full house plus, so our theater seats about 600 people. And every seat was filled, and we had standing room and then people that were out in the hallways. And the message was very, very powerful and impactful, and that's exactly what we wanted for the evening. Opportunities is really focused on helping teens and their parents develop resiliency skills. And we all know that life is tough and that we're going to have challenges and obstacles to deal with, but how we choose to deal with them is going to define the rest of our life. And I think the thing that I took most away from Elizabeth Smart's keynote speech is that she said things will happen to us and they shape us, but they do not define us. And I hope that is what our students are thinking about today, regardless of their situation, that they are not defined by their circumstance or what is happening, and that they do have the choice to live and have the life that they are seeking and wanting.
Okay, so that's something you guys do every year?
We do. This was our fifth annual, and usually we have breakout sessions, and our focus is for it to be our parent night, where parents and teens can come and learn about everything from bullying, substance abuse, and prevention. We work closely with the Summit County Sheriff's Department, and they bring information for parents to be watching for to help their children in case they're seeing signals or signs of things that aren't good in their lives. Summit County Health partners with us, of course, the Children's Justice Center and Peace House, and so many good partners that we're so grateful for that this event wouldn't happen without.
Okay, let's see. The board last year had approved full-day kindergarten to start this year, and you opened the school year offering this. Is this a voluntary program at this point?
This is a voluntary program, but we did not have one student opt out, which kind of surprised me. I was excited. I know that our principal and myself had conversations with parents that had some apprehensions and some concerns, but all of them have decided that they were going to go with the program that was offered and be able to see how it worked for their family and for their children.
So did you know that before the first day of school, so you were fully staffed then to handle them all?
Yes. We had hired during the summer to have the staffing that we needed, and it's been exciting, as this is the first grader's first year of all day and the kindergartner's first day. And so you can imagine what the lunchroom is like and recess and things like that. But for the academic benefit is well worth the challenges that it presents.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that academic benefit, because we hear, it costs money now, but it actually saves money in the long run.
Yes, and that is exactly what we're hoping for, is that as our students transition from the elementary school into the middle school and the high school, that they're more academically prepared and we can go deeper into rigor rather than breadth and review. And the key focus is getting those literacy skills down in grades kindergarten through third. And so we have some very specific district goals in regards to improving our literacy rates and making sure that all students can read, because once you can read, the other academic subjects become much easier to be able to conquer.
Yeah, and certainly, as you know, for some students, reading is a big challenge. So how are you helping those that do struggle with?
You know, we incorporate technology, and then we also have some excellent reading literacy programs. We also have a community partner that has come in and has formed a partnership and bring a part-time teacher to work with some of our lowest reading students. We have paraeducators, and in the past, oftentimes the paraeducators have taken those struggling readers and worked with them. Our transition is that the paraeducators will work with those students that are at level or beyond and help them to advance, while the teacher is actually working with those readers that are struggling most.
Yeah, and what we're not trying to do, I guess, is how we teach traditional readers, and that's the phonics and the sounding out of words. I mean, we need to find new ways to teach them, because that's not the way they learn.
Absolutely, and we've made sure there's been some professional learning opportunities for our faculty and for our staff so that they are equipped with those 21st century learning skills.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. There are parents that still read to their children, but many, many don't because, and I think technology plays into that because students can listen to stories and they can, on the devices at home, and so parents aren't spending the time reading with their children that maybe we used to.
Ah, interesting. I mean, so they're sitting alongside actually seeing the words that are being spoken. So how that is still, they find what important.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Hmm. You're bursting at the seams already besides kindergarten. So where did you put everybody?
So we're using nooks and crannies and filling classrooms. Fortunately, one of the benefits of South Summit School District is our classrooms are smaller. I shouldn't say classrooms. Our class sizes are slightly smaller than other districts. That's been very intentional. But as the population is increasing, those are creeping up. And that is something that the Board of Education is concerned about and recognizing that how are we going to do this because the classrooms only have so much capacity. And all of our buildings are just inching to that capacity. This year we have 1,760 students, and in our projection with the professional strategic planners that they had looked at a couple years ago, they had predicted we'd have 1,756. So we're right on target with the projected growth, and if that projected growth continues as predicted, we'll be at 2,500 students by year 2028. And so that is the reason that the Board of Education has passed a resolution to propose a bond for our community this November.
Yeah. Before we turn to the bond, in terms of the cost of additional kindergarten, did that require a tax increase?
It did not. We did that with, we didn't do truth in taxation, but we did have to hire an additional two teachers. Now, one of those teachers has been funded through the Teacher and Student Success Act, which is new legislative money that was given to the school. And then the school also chose to use trust land money to help support this innovation. And that saved us from needing to be able to do the truth in taxation this year.
Okay. So let's see, coming up November 5th, of course, there will be a ballot proposal for those within the school district. What's going to be on that bond language?
So the bond language will be $87 million to build a new high school, and it will be a comprehensive high school that includes all of the academic programming, everything from, of course, your core subjects of math and English to your extracurricular career and technical education types of courses, vocational training, and also athletic fields and extracurricular space.
Okay, but no money for a elementary then, huh?
So, no, and in previous times we've been on the show, we've been talking about $75 million, and so I feel it prudent that I need to address that. In the time that we've been talking about that until they've actually predicted where costs are today and what they will be when we start to build, it would be the $87 million. Now, the good news for our district is that because of growth, and because of interest rates and the way the bond would be structured and the contribution of the board towards our capital funds, the money that we're asking from the average household is actually less than it was 2 years ago when we bonded. And it's important, I think, for people to not be focused on what is the cost of the bond, but what is the cost of the bond to me personally.
So how has that dropped? Can you give us an idea?
Yeah, so the tax impact on citizens is $10 less per 100,000 than what was projected on the 2017 bond proposal. So not significant, but it is less. And I think sometimes people hear the bond is for more, and so they're thinking it's astronomical what it's going to cost them, and it's important to realize it's actually going to be less out of the average person's home.
And that was how much were you... The bond, was it at 56?
It was a $56 million bond.
Yeah, so you're getting $30 million more.
And paying less.
Okay. So what are you targeting it at, though? For is it per $100,000 or is it per average median house? Or what's the tax going to be?
Yeah, it's per $100,000. And so for a primary residence, it's $7 a month or $85 annually. per 100,000.
Okay.
And then the county has determined that the average home in Summit or in the South Summit School District is 423,000. So that would be about $30 a month. But again, recognizing that those take into account those secondary homes, that some are very, very expensive. And so as I've been talking to people and they've looked at their tax notices, many are finding that they're not the average home. They're below that. And so somewhere in that $7 to $30 range is what the average probably person living in the community would be paying.
Okay. You have said that should the bond not pass, then you'll just go towards portable classrooms. That comes at a cost too, though. I mean, so does how does that get paid for then?
You know, portables are very expensive. The board will be talking in their meeting on Thursday night about kind of plan B if this doesn't pass. Would they consider proposing another bond next year? And would the bond be to purchase portables and create a portable school? Because we do have some space next to the district office and maybe pull a grade from each of the schools to open up classroom space. Or would it be put portables at the individual schools, but that takes into the playground space that we already don't have enough of? Or would it be to maybe look at bonding for a different type of a school, whether it may be an elementary, which helps at the lower end, but it doesn't help the higher end?
Yeah. So what have you seen over at the Silver Summit Academy? Is that at capacity?
We are at capacity. I mean, at the secondary level, we've saved some spots, and at the elementary, they are full, but we also have the capacity if needed, if some of those residents move into the homes that are being built right now. But at the elementary level, as far as school choicing, there isn't space. There would only be space for those that would be living in the school boundaries. Yeah. But the secondary still has a few spaces at different grades, not across the
Yeah,
board.
And that's something we have heard is that as many as 80 students from the Park City School District have been admitted into the Silver Summit Academy. So if you do get capacity, then those kids would be booted out, basically you'd close the school?
We would close the school, and typically what you try and do when you close a school is to allow those students to finish at least – you know, if they're in elementary, at least to finish to the end of the elementary and then transition. And you do try and be supportive if they have siblings coming in. But yes, that would be the option.
Okay. As you mentioned, you're right on the growth targets. That final count doesn't happen, of course, until October 1st for funding
Correct.
Purposes. So what are the class sizes looking like, though? I mean, so you were ready for them?
Yes, we have some high school classes that are up into the 40s. We try and keep our pre-K through third grade down into the 25 or lower. And then in those areas in which we have more than the 25 in the lower grades or past 30, then you start looking at support of paraeducators in the classroom helping the teacher.
Yeah, I can understand, you know, a PE class of 40, but when you start talking about an English class or an essay class, that's pretty tough on a teacher, no?
Yeah, and where we see the larger classes in the high school are more in your social sciences, your history, your psychology type of classes. We've been able to keep our math and our English core classes a little bit lower for a manageable workload and educational experience.
Okay. You have had the job for business administrator position open. Has that been filled at this point?
It has. I'm sorry. Adam Robinson has accepted that position. He is phenomenal. He has retired from the Utah National Guard, where he served a career doing this type of work, as well as led combat missions overseas. He comes with a wealth of experience. The district is very much appreciating the expertise that he's bringing and the leadership that he's bringing to that position.
Yeah. Does he live in South Summit?
He actually lives near the area and has family in the South Summit area.
But you don't have to find him a place to live?
Right. We were very fortunate about that.
Okay. Shad, anything else you want to mention?
Just appreciate the Park City Community Foundation and want to give a shout out to them for their support of our Opportunities Night, which made it possible for then Elizabeth Smart to give what would have been a small per diem to her towards scholarships. And so she awarded two scholarships last night to two of our students. They're younger, so they'll go into a savings bond and will grow so that they have that money available when they go to college.
Great. All right.
Thank you.
Thanks. That's the superintendent of South Summit Schools, Shad Sorensen. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Good morning. Well, the Park City Council meeting tomorrow to discuss special events policy, traffic circulation in Old Town, as well as an update on Treasure Hill's open space. In the studio with me now, I have Economic Development Manager Jonathan Weidenhammer. Good morning.
Good morning.
So the council will have the work session reviewing some changes made to the special event code that year after implementing them. Can you kind of summarize those changes and tell us why they were made?
Sure. As a reminder, there was this idea of event fatigue running around in the community, and council asked to put together an advisory committee consisting of residents. And through their input and a lot of back and forth, we came to council with some recommendations to try to get a better hold on events. Again, the goal that I've been asked to react to from council is how can we reduce the impacts of the what I call the proliferation of the resort economy on the livability of Old Town in particular and the rest of the community. And so what we did was we put a cap on the big events. You know, we re-changed how we structured them into different levels. So we stratified them into five different types, with four and fives being the biggest. And we put a cap on the threes, the fours, and the fives. We did deregulate events at resorts. We said, hey, you know, up to level three, if there's no cop, public safety, transportation impacts, the resorts are meant to do this. They've got restrooms and parking lots and staff. So we're not going to worry about that. And then we said, hey, there's a lot of peak times where we're already loaded, you know, the 4th of July and Labor Day weekend. We don't need to approve any more events during that time. And then we set up what I call a facilitating process so that the new events are reviewed against each other. So if somebody new wants to come in, you're going to compete for new time with other events that want to come in. And I think in general, we continue to hear some grumblings or mumblings about, do we still have event fatigue? What are we still doing? And I think Jenny Dearson and her event staff and the rest of our team feel pretty good about where we've been and how it's going. We've had numerous applications that haven't even made it to council. You know, we've re-clarified our criteria that it's not just economic development focused, it's community goal focused, it's community fun focused. So we've had a number of small events I don't think people probably know about. I think we have 8 new ones this year, but they're all pretty small. They're community based. We've shed about 14 events from the 2018 calendar into 2019, and we've told people that have been here for years, like, hey, you don't meet the new criteria, and it's not going to work anymore for you. And there's a number, again, that are at resort bases that don't really need permits. And so we feel like we're rowing in the same direction of council's expectation and community goals. I still hear a little bit of event fatigue, and so for me, I wonder, you know, the city's role in terms of facilitating this kind of thing. I think the economy's busy. I think it's busy out there. I think we have reduced the city's role in facilitating and enabling some of these things and realigned community goals with our event permits. Yeah.
So like the Deer Valley Concerts, that's not a level three event. So that does have to go through the more stricter.
It goes through the bigger process. And, mm-hmm. you know, tied to that has been staff's expectation through council that we are going to further mitigate for the impacts. And so Deer Valley is a great example where we've put in massive transit and parking plans that they've worked really, really hard and put a lot of money into. I think they probably put north of $90,000 or $100,000 into additional operational planning, and the city's, you know, worked with them to provide enhanced transit service, in particular like a direct route, that kind of an express route that runs between the high school and Deer Valley.
Yeah, we're also talking about weaning special events off of the fee reductions, and I think we saw an example of that again with the Deer Valley Concerts when they had come in and asked for some help with the additional parking mitigation. One event this year that had a large fee reduction was the World Championships. The council will also be debriefed on Thursday. They had applied for a reduction of $222,000. Actual fees were $155,000. So does that money come back?
Well, it doesn't come back. It's just money we don't have to kind of waive or give away. And so it's come and gone. We had, you know, what I would call a one-time allowance. We were able to plan for this event 3 years in advance, and so we knew that there was going to be a pretty substantial hit, and we worked pretty hard with our budget folks and transit folks and police folks to project what that was. And, you know, that was in the name of the council understanding our ongoing commitment to world-class athletics and the resort bases and our place in the resort economy. And I was really proud of everybody for how how kind of stringently we did run the budget and how well the resorts operated and the partnership between the city and the resorts, we were able to significantly reduce or, you know, bring in less than we thought it would cost that those operations.
Yeah. You, Special Events Manager Jenny Dearson and Senior Transportation Planner Alexis Versen, part of the team looking at traffic access and circulation in Old Town, you've made a few easy tweaks this summer. We saw the 4th and 5th Street changes, one directional. You're also proposing 5 new drop-off and load zones in front of the Brew Pub and OP Rockwell's, Chimayo, the Post Office, 9th Street Trolley Turnaround, and then Sweet Alley across from the Transit Center. So why these locations?
I'd like to say it's more science than art, but right now it's more art than science. You know, staff has gone out there and we've talked to the lodging companies and we've talked to the for-hire taxi folks and tried to make our best estimate on where these should be. We had a heat map generated of where the restaurant square feet are that tend to generate a lot of these drop and load areas. And we identified in the beginning kind of a 15 or so alternatives, and we reduced it to these, I think it's 6. Areas that we are recommending we kind of roll out a trial period. So before 5 o'clock, these are all going to be 15-minute parking. After 5 o'clock, 3 of them, Chimayo, Brew Pub, and now in front of kind of Dolly's area museum, will be drop and load only. You have to get in and get out. But then we got some really good feedback from our for-hire taxi folks that said they really need some staging areas. And so we think having one in Sweet Alley, having one in front of the post office the way it functions now, and then down at 9th Street where you can park your car and wait for kind of that fare. Or if, you know, the uphill lodging company wants to keep a car down here instead of circulating around or going all the way back up to Upper Deer Valley, makes some sense to keep them down here.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, those 3 staging areas, a favorite one, though, is right out here in Sweet Alley in front of the Trigo walkway there. So, I mean, if they're going somewhere where they're not supposed to be, is that then, I mean, do they get ticketed or
I appreciate, now you're getting back to the more art than science, right? We've got some stuff to figure out. Enforcement's going to be one that starts soft and hopefully by Christmas gets firm. And, you know, we know there's some bigger shuttle companies that run vans in the back of Sweet Alley where we don't have a proposed commercial vehicle load zone right now. And we have to figure that out. We've been working with lodging and those companies individually to have an iterative process on what are we going to do to figure that out. We know we got some stuff to work on.
You also have a survey out to the Historic Park City Alliance. Have you seen the responses from that yet?
We haven't seen them yet. We anticipate them by Thursday. They were pretty split on what to do with these zones before 5 o'clock. Some of them understood the idea of 15-minute parking, and some of them thought the paid parking actually helped facilitate turnover. So they haven't given me a final determination yet. They are aware that I intend to move forward with my recommendation as is. I think council will probably understand that for now.
And that would be the free
free 15-minute parking before 5 o'clock. You know, it's going to be hard if there's somebody in there doing paid parking and then I have to, like, try to tow somebody that's there. It just seems more continuity is important as we roll this out.
Okay. It looks like the Old Town Access and Circulation Plan could cost the city about $270,000. So what does that scope of work cover?
A lot of data collection. And what I'm trying to be fluent in is the cost of collecting data and running traffic models. That's not a vocabulary I'm deep in. And it's expensive, but I think at the same time to with integrity look at the council and recommend, I think, capital projects that will come out of this, they need to be rooted in science. And we need to have a really firm and good understanding of where trips are coming from, where cars are coming from, how many of them are going down hillside, how many are coming up Park Avenue, what times are they coming, what is the intersection of Deer Valley Drive and Park Avenue look like, you know, where we have the box of rocks that says don't go up Park Avenue. So we have to kind of chase down the root of the problem, and to do that, it's looking like it may be expensive. We're working with the consulting team to come up with the final scope right now. It's going to include, you know, the event peak day operational plan. Hey, what do we do during Sundance and President's Weekend? So it's a pretty dynamic plan, and it's not a study. It's a plan to do projects. And anytime you're going to build real projects, a new road, a turnaround, a cut through behind China Bridge, it's got to be rooted in, you know, real plans and real thought.
Okay. So if once approved, that study then would happen kind of as the Christmas Sundance President's Day.
Stuff. Yeah, I think we're going to try to take it in bites. I expect to bring it back, that contract back to council. It may be in a work session. It may be just the contract to make sure we're good on the scope. and make sure they're comfortable with how we intend to move forward. And I think it's likely we can take it in some pieces. One, you know, the Sundance event plan, and then what's the data building up to finally what's an ultimate plan.
City Manager Diane, hang on just a sec. You wanted to add something?
Oh, sorry, I just wanted to jump in. Jonathan makes a really good point about this. This is less of a study and more of a plan. And I think for folks on Hillside and in that area and in Old Town, I think this is one of those that they should really want to have happen. Because, for example, looking at can we put in a road that connects Marsac to Sweet Alley behind China Bridge? Is that possible? Is there the grading there? And really looking deep at what alternative solutions exist out there. That's really important. And as staff, you know, we've recommended that. We've got current council direction to move that way.
Okay.
Can I add one thing to that? We've had a lot of resident feedback this week since the publishing of the report about what I would call the, quote, roundabout at the bottom of a hillside. You had alluded to the temporary and interim minor steps we do this summer, the 4th and the 5th Street switches, that kind of thing. For 2 years, we've been working on a list of tiered projects, and one of them was, I call it a pork chop at the bottom of Hillside. It's something that would help commercial traffic that's kind of leaked out of the commercial district not make its way up through Hillside or into Daly, but instead try to turn around. And where I would agree that it would be more effective if that happened kind of near the Brew Pub or Grappa intersection, that would take significant utility realignments and some real work and grading. The tiered projects we've always talked about for years had a small turnaround at the bottom of Hillside. So it's not intended to be a Deer Valley scaled roundabout. It's intended to be just a small thing with a little sign in it that says, like, hey, stop, turn around. You're bleeding into the residential district. Stop. So, again, there's a number of emails out there, a lot of upset folks up in that neighborhood of the world. But I'd like them to know that the intention isn't to have a major roundabout up there.
The council looking at some capital improvement projects on Treasure Hill. What's the plan there?
Minor stuff, you know, not dissimilar to Bonanza Flat. Anytime you buy a significant piece of property and you have to be a steward for what happens next on it, it comes in bites and pieces. We're talking about a little trailhead. When I say trailhead, I think it's an existing kind of shoulder of a road that people already park on. It would be kind of firming that up with curb and gutter to make the building official happy. And it's a kiosk. And then coming with the kiosk and coming in dog poop bags, that kind of thing. I think council tonight is also going to consider accepting a donation of public art, which looks like a bronze statue from the Martinez family. So those are separate, but kind of similar. Obviously, if you look up that hill, there's a lot of dead trees up there. The city has to put together a forestry and wild land fire interface plan. So it's just, you know, taking it in bite-sized steps.
So is this trailhead then going to be there kind of at the horseshoe turn?
Yeah, I read the staff report this morning. I noticed it didn't say where. It would be where the horseshoe is between Lowell and Empire.
Okay. And then the bronze statue then that's supposed to go of Rich Martinez, where would that be? There?
Yeah, right there. So this public art board has made a recommendation to accept the donation. We're asking council to accept that with the intent that we would locate it there. We can always decide later if that's not the right place for it. We can put it somewhere else.
Okay. And then just in the interest of full disclosure, the council considering an item related to our building expansion here at KPCW, the council has already approved two other items regarding the expansion plan. So what's left?
So this is really the council consummating a purchase and sale agreement to complete the transaction, the financial transaction between the parties. The planning department's approved the expansion, which is cantilevered north above the little Bob Wells Plaza. I think maybe it's 10 or 12 feet north and maybe 10 or 12 feet west, maybe a little bit bigger either way, but it's a pretty minor addition, which was already contemplated when we built the original building in 2009. And this is really just KPCW ensuring, you know, a 20-year future in the space that they're in now.
Yeah, the what I kind of read through going through that was that the new space apparently has to be net zero. So do all new buildings now in town require to have that same feature?
They don't, but the city has a policy related to our buildings that they all will be net zero. There's probably some minor exceptions if it's only an addition of 25% or whatnot, but through the negotiations, one of the things the city asked for the trade of the air rights, the value of the air rights that we're giving you of city property, was that that KPCW would have the new addition have no new energy footprint. So the old building doesn't have to be. So if you guys consume 10 carbons right now, when the new 1,300 square feet come online, you would still consume 10 carbons. Does that make sense?
But my understanding was that we couldn't put any solar panels up on the roof, the green roof building part.
Ultimately, we had that discussion, and I think the cost to put solar on the roof would be pretty prohibitive right now. So the plan would be to model or understand the current carbon footprint of the existing building, build the new building. It includes a major interior renovation, so you're gutting systems and lighting and everything else. So the intent would be that you're going to have significant energy efficiency realizations through that remodel process, and it will model it when we're done with construction. And if we're still not at the equal, we'll start to pursue next steps. We've given 3 or 4 years to do that. If that's solar, great. If it's some other measures, we'll have to figure that out then.
Yeah, we know what happened to the mark, though, right? I mean,
yeah, nothing's ever easy.
Energy increased like twice.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, right. It can be a complex process. There's no intention to. I think we just want to go into it eyes wide open, and you know, the architect Elliott Work Group has. Made some preliminary assumptions and delivered some preliminary analysis. We feel pretty good about where it's going.
Okay. Jonathan, Diane, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Well, Summit County has announced a new behavioral health crisis phone line in the studio to tell us about it. I have Aaron Newman. He's Director of Behavioral Health for the Summit County Health Department. Also with Nelson Clayton from the Healthy You Behavioral Summit County, the manager of the Behavioral Health Government Programs. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Morning.
Aaron, let's start with you. This was the use plan, or was this like something that Summit County had negotiated as part of the new contract with the U?
So it's a little of both. This is really sort of tying into some past legislation that's taking place. One of the things you've heard me talk about before is a new 3-digit crisis line number coming down the pipeline. The FCC has approved it. We're just all in the process now of waiting to find out what those 3 digits will be. That'll tie into a state crisis line. But we knew we also needed crisis services more directly here that weren't just funneled down to Salt Lake and then dispatched out. So the number we have here in Summit County, which is 833-959-1295, and that goes straight to our operations here. I give that number out. We do have a second number for that's our overall crisis line. But if you call that number, you can speak to a person here in Summit County during normal business hours at the new Uni Operations, the University Neuropsychiatric Institute. And after operations, then it forwards on to the actual crisis line itself. So with these operations, we're able to have not only someone to talk to, but also you can come into the new Uni Center here in Summit County at 1820 Sidewinder over in Prospector, which is right next to the IHC clinic. Or you can call down to the dispatch.
Okay, so this is not 911.
No, this is not 911. However, if you're ever in a crisis and you feel you or someone right there is imminent harm to themselves, always call 911 right away.
Okay, and Nelson, so who's staffing this? Your folks?
We have a lot of clinicians from the University of Utah. Uni is going to be staffed by clinicians from down. They're just bringing up their clinic from the University of Utah. So they're bringing a lot of clinicians. We're also going to have a lot of community providers. So we've reached out to licensed clinicians in the community to be working with our plan as well. So we're hoping to have a really big network of providers to help people get access to mental health care, which has been a huge problem and challenge in Utah.
And I think that network's important to point out. We're in early talks with Wasatch County members and Wasatch Mental Health to see how can we create a regional approach to this. The state has created these things called MCOTs, Mobile Crisis Outreach Teams. Unfortunately, there's nowhere near enough to service the whole state. So the one that serves Summit County is based out of Tooele and serves Tooele County, Summit County, and then Salt Lake County. So if we have a crisis in Tooele and another one here, we're not going to get that team in any reasonable amount of time. So we're creating what we're calling a stabilization team that's going to be made up of network providers that can be that on-call and sent out to situations. So if you're a deputy or a police officer and you're dealing with the situation in the community and you're like, your crisis intervention training kicks in and you're like, you know what, this is at a next level, that team can be sent to your location and to help with that and to make those referrals as needed.
Yeah. So this is 24/7. So does that mean that anybody would... Or they're kind of taking shifts so that they know they're on call?
Mm-hmm. So when you call down to Uni, they have a whole entire staff of licensed clinical social workers. They have physicians. And we're tapping into this network, too, to look at supplementing some of our services, such as in the jail and other areas, so we have full county coverage. The crisis team will be a rotating. People will sign up for that, and they'll rotate on call. But the crisis line is manned 24/7 by people that's their job.
Okay. So it started September 1st. Have you had any calls?
We haven't received any information that I've seen yet. We're still in the early phases of reporting. I get a monthly report, and that won't be till October 1st.
And I guess just to differentiate, maybe this is where you can help, Clayton. I mean, why would somebody call this as opposed to 911? 911 means that the trauma has happened?
I would say that this would be something before someone is in imminent harm to self or others. So, you know, we want to have a door open that if you're in a crisis, a mental health crisis, that you don't want to have that response. But 911 is the best option if there's an imminent harm. So we never want to say, call our crisis line if someone could be hurt right away. But, you know, mental health just has a different profile. And if it's something that you feel like calling and getting a response that's different could support someone who's going through a mental health crisis, then we want to be able to provide that as well and take that burden, frankly, off of the 911 responders.
Right. Tom, talk to me that this, and anybody can call. I mean, is
yes.
I mean, even what if somebody from Wasatch County, or they're welcome to call it too? Or
they can, because as I said, the rollover will take place after hours to the state line that is able to access resources anywhere. And that always ties into one thing I like to push is the Safe UT app. It's a crisis response tool that I have mixed emotions. The good news with it is Summit County utilizes Safe UT more than any other community in Utah. And while that may seem concerning, to me that says, okay, people know that that's a resource that they can use that they weren't accessing before. So they're reaching out to get the help that they can, whether it's through using the call feature or the text feature in the app. So I always recommend people go online, go to your Android store, go to iTunes store, download the Safe UT app and use it. It's set up for schools. We really don't care about that. Just pick a school, sign up as a student, but have that tool available.
Yeah. The deal also is that it, insurance or no, you're still welcome to call.
Correct.
This is a free call?
It's a free call, and it can be anonymous as well. You don't necessarily have to give any identifying information if you choose not to.
Okay. Anything else you guys want to talk about?
I think with this new partnership, we're having some great things happen. And one area I don't know if we have time for Nelson to talk about is our school-based services. It's something I'm extremely excited about. This is the first time we have all of our charter and public schools having therapists on site in the school to see students as well as to be a resource for faculty and staff.
So we've begun staffing schools for 4 hours a week with licensed clinicians who will be in the schools. And their marching orders, in the past they were fee-for-service providers who would come in and do a session and then leave. These clinicians are supposed to be there to support the whole school. And so that can include talking to teachers. It can involve sitting in a class to observe how things are going. We've had one clinician already who I love to talk about, and she talked to some of the teachers about their feelings around an active shooter training. And at the end of the day, I think what could be better than supporting the teachers and their feelings, because that's going to translate to the children. So obviously we're going to be there to help the children, but I want to focus on being proactive. How do we create an ecosystem in the schools that can really be about growth and learning and emotional wellness, in addition to taking care of the people that need specialized therapeutic services?
Yeah. And Aaron, at what point, I mean, we're starting to talk now about kind of regional planning, Summit and Wasatch County. At what point does something like this happen? Wouldn't it make a lot more sense to have this on a two-county basis?
Well, in some respects it is. It's part of, there's these things called the mandated services that we as a local mental health district have to provide. In the past, it's been hard for us to do a regional approach because you're limited to your boundaries. Summit County is somewhat unique in that we're a standalone district. We're just our county. Wasatch County and Utah County make up a separate district, so they coordinate in that ends. But thanks to our new partnership with the University of Utah, and specifically Healthy U Behavioral, they serve as the accountable care organization for the state in terms of Medicaid expansion. And because of that role, they now have jurisdiction and connection in all of the local authority districts. So that's why we're able now to partner with Salt Lake and with Wasatch, and something we've never been able to do before.
Right. Okay. Aaron Newman, Nelson Clayton, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
8:54 now. Good morning. Well, coming up next Thursday, September 19th, Hearth and Hill at Kimball Junction hosting the inaugural Dirt to Dish special dinner event. In the studio to tell us more about that, I have the co-owner of the restaurant, Brooks Kirschheimer, and Megan Miller. She's the executive director of Eats. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
So, Brooks, why don't you tell us what's happening a week from tomorrow?
So on Thursday, September 19th at 6 p.m., we're going to close the restaurant for a really fun Dirt to Dish event that will be happening. And, you know, this was inspired because there's always these great wine dinners and beer dinners, but we didn't think there's ever really an event that supports the purveyors that are out there working really hard in the fields or in the butcher shops or in the bread shops, like Red Bicycle and Wild Harvest Farms, Copper Moose, Renewy Gardens, Beltex, and the new Park City Creamery. And we really wanted to showcase them because they work really hard. And I was inspired by a chef I worked with in Hawaii, Peter Merriman, just to have the love of farmers and that they really are heroes because they work really hard and provide us with a great product. And at times we don't always show them the satisfaction that they deserve. And so we're really excited about this event to have all of them in one place at one time, which is a rare appearance.
Okay, so they're going to be at the restaurant kind of what, just intermingling? Or I mean, how does...
Correct, yeah. So our chef, Jordan Harvey, who is truly a local chef, who you know, Leslie, and really does a great job of connecting with the farmers and the butchers and the bread makers in this community, as well as the Eats Foundation, is going to bring them all together. And we'll have a different item, a couple items from each of them that showcase their product in a way that Jordan can do. And it's really going to be exciting. And then as well, we'll have a couple kids from Eats there doing a couple food items as well, showcasing what they do really well.
Okay. So are you shutting the restaurant down?
Correct. Yep. One night only. We'll have Shannon Runyon, a great local musician, will be playing some great tunes. We'll have the bar open and at $65 tickets and really just a fun event for locals to come out and support all the farmers and all the other purveyors that they really love in this town. Like I mentioned, that you know the crack bread from Red Bicycle and the great greens from Copper Moose and the tomatoes from Renewy Gardens and great meats from Beltex that everybody can come out and enjoy.
Okay. People can get tickets just by calling the restaurant?
Calling the restaurant, 435-200-8840, or by emailing events at hearth-hill.com.
Okay. Are you going to have just one service, one dinner service?
Yes. Or, yep. Okay. Just, yeah, the one event, and we're really excited about it. We think it's going to be a great, unique event that people will really enjoy and that there's a great meaning behind it, and a portion of the proceeds will go to the Eats because we really love to support them, and Chef Jordan has done cooking classes with them, and we think that there's a great symbiotic relationship with them for what we're trying to do and obviously what Eats is accomplishing as well.
Okay, you're just going to try and cover your cost and then the
correct
the rest yep. goes to Eats?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, well, let's bring Megan in to talk a little bit about it. This is your first full school year as Eats director?
Yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, what have you got planned for the school year?
We've expanded our after-school education, so we're now in all four elementary schools 2 days a week. So we do one elementary school a week, and so we do Tuesdays gardening, and then Fridays they expand on the garden lesson and loop that into the cooking classes. And we're also really excited to partner with more of the local purveyors. Like many of the purveyors that Brooks mentioned are supporters of Eats as well, and they help with our programming as guest instructors, teaching kids, you know, where ingredients come from, how the different like disciplines within culinary arts are.
Yeah. So is this something that children sign up for to participate in, or is it just offered to?
So with the after school program, if kids are signed up for the after school program, they're automatically enrolled for our community classes that are starting to roll out. They have to sign up for those. Our Mountain Eats camp, the UEA camp that we do in conjunction with Park City Mountain, is open, and that is open to anyone who wants to sign up. We have 24 slots. Of that 24, I think we have at least 6 that are scholarship. If anyone's interested in a scholarship, they can email zoe@eatsparkcity.org. And because we want all kids to be able to participate in culinary arts and growing their skills and enjoyment of cooking and learning about, you know, the environment and nutrition.
And we should mention Eats is Eat Awesome Things at School. And it started, I'm thinking, 3 or 4 years ago. And at that time, kind of had a 3-year plan with the school district in terms of changing things and in terms of what was happening with school food. Has that mission been accomplished?
Yes, we've been very lucky to have such a great partner in the district. I know that it hasn't always been as smooth as it initially had been thought, but the district has really stepped up, and there are scratch-cooked meals in the elementary schools now. We are working with the district to get the upper schools, Ecker and Treasure, ready for scratch-cooked foods, but it's a big overhaul. It's a lot of additional work and demand on the staff. It's additional demand on the space as well. The kitchens were not designed for exactly what we wanted them to be, and so the district is working on helping make those goals more achievable. But as we got into the work of school lunch, we realized that school lunch and, you know, eating at school is only part of the equation. And so we decided that to really have an impact and grow a healthier generation and empower parents and children to be more healthy and nourished, that we needed to start doing more community outreach as well, because there are a lot of people that don't do traditional school. Some are homeschooled, some like winter sports school, or that are in the day school, aren't exposed to our programming yet. But what we found from parents and from kids and from community members is that they're all just as interested in our programming. And so we're trying to make it more accessible to everyone, because our mission is that everyone have access to fresh, nutritious foods and overall to grow a healthier generation.
Okay, so $65 tickets plus tax plus any alcohol or bar service you may have, 435-200-8840.
Yeah, come out and support and see all the purveyors together, which is a rare opportunity to see them all mingling and getting to talk to the farmers and the bakers and the everybody else that gets to make the great products that you enjoy on a daily basis here in Park City.
Okay.
I'm excited. It's going to be a delicious event.
Okay. Brooks and Megan, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.